Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Alarm, alarm. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, James Holland, and Jim. Let's get to it because we have an amazingly special guest. It's good to have him back, but he's since we last spoke, as we were just saying before we got started, a great deal has happened. So who are we talking to today, James?
Well, great friend of the show. It's John Orloff, and, you know, writer of two of the most iconic episodes of Band of Brothers ever, and writer of everything on Masters of the Air.
Almost. Not
just
quite.
Almost everything. But anyway, lead writer, kind of, you know, number top dog on the writing front.
Well, generally there for the whole thing. As it were.
Yeah, the master of the air. And John, it's great to see you and great to have you back on the show. Thank you.
It's so great to be back. And B, just so you know, this is my first interview and first podcast for Masters of the Air. So who better to start this with than you guys?
Well, how about that?
You flatter us. That's amazing. And what's brilliant is I don't know whether we're recording this at the moment or not, but from a film point of view, but in the background of your office, there are stands of B-17 models in formation. There's also a rapier, a 17th century rapier, but there's also an RAF sector clock. There's another model of a B-17.
Yeah, you didn't get the flashlight next to the B-17.
Yes, there's a flashlight there as well. And I remember, John, like you were getting near to the end of the filming when you and I had supper in Windsor, where you were staying, because it was a lovely spot for you, but it was also close to where you were filming it all. Mm-hmm. And I remember you showing me a stack of photographs of the kind of attention to detail that was put in place, you know, from the right type of bottles behind the bar and the kind of the typewriter with an accurate memo in the typewriter and so on and so forth. I mean, it was just amazing.
We took an immense amount of pride in getting details right. And what is amazing is an amazingly large amount of people worked on this show. I mean, I'm not exaggerating when I say thousands. That's not an exaggeration. Right. And so there's a lot of people working on this thing, trying to get it right and trying to get all of those details right.
Yeah.
And particularly the art department and the effects department. I sort of think as both of those guys, they were men who ran those departments, Steven Rosenbaum on the effects and this wonderful guy, Chris Seegers, a Brit, on the art direction and sets and design of the whole show. And I think of these two guys as my co-writers as well, because their dedication to telling the story, like literally telling the story, which is writing, right? And getting it correct was amazing. And I'll just give you a couple of good examples to get us started. So you'll see in the show that there's quite a lot of aerial combat. The show is really about aerial combat. But what's interesting is, like, for example, there's a shot in the trailer of the B-17s and the camera's kind of looking down on them and they're headed on a, they're on their bomb run, I think. Hmm. And a couple of things about that one shot. One is every single plane will be tracked for the whole mission by the special effects team. So when we make a formation in the show, say like these planes in formation, we track every single one. So we know that's on Trondheim, that's Crosby's plane. That one is Biddick's plane. That one is Clevin's plane. And they were color-coded during post-production. So when you saw an unfinished special effect, oh, that red one is the first element of the 418th. The yellow planes are the second element of the 350th. And that's important because there are characters in those elements that we're tracking that are in this sequence. But that's the kind of like any time, or another thing, anytime you see a plane hit by a rocket, oh, it was hit by a rocket. That's not a random thing when you see a rocket in our show. They were hit by rockets. And in that, whatever particular time you see a rocket hitting a B-17, that's what happened to that particular B-17 in that particular mission. And we do that
in real life. So what really happened back in you know, August 43 or whatever it might be.
Depends on the battle sequence. You know, we have more than one in the show. So we have, you know, rockets were actually used quite a bit by the Germans and play. So either ground to air, which they also did, but they also did obviously air to air. And it was actually quite effective. So we only use it when it happened, when I find it in the research. You know, it's an incredibly well-researched show.
That's amazing. That's absolutely amazing.
John, is it finished or is there a computer still grinding away doing finishing
touches? It's 99.999999% finished.
Okay.
it's pretty finished. And we're just super excited about it.
A thought has just occurred to me, which is on the off chance that anyone listening to this doesn't know what we're talking about, which seems it seems absolutely incredible.
Your fan base in particular would hopefully know what this
is. Do you think we should just very briefly, in literally 30 seconds, just explain what we're talking about?
Do the elevator pitch, John.
Yeah, well, the elevator pitch is, as you kindly said in the introduction, I wrote a couple of the episodes of Band of Brothers, which... the greatest experience of my life. And about 10 years ago, Tom Hanks asked me to be a part of Masters of the Air, only write a couple of episodes, which is a follow-up of Band of Brothers and the Pacific, sort of the third in a trilogy of Steven Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Gary Getzman exploring World War II and the real stories of World War II. And so this is the third one, and it took a little bit longer to make. It's a little more complicated than the others. We're finally done. And coming on Apple Plus January 26th.
Yes. And for those who don't know, this follows the, it's based on Don Miller's book, which was originally called, I think, The Mighty Eighth.
It was always called Masters of the Air. And then there was a weird internet rumor that our show was going to be called The Mighty Eighth, which it never was. Because some other people made like a trailer to a B-17 movie, like on spec. They made like a spec trailer. And it was on the internet as The Mighty Eighth. And from that moment on, people thought that was us.
I think maybe it's because my edition is definitely The Mighty Ape. And
is it a UK thing?
Some such. Maybe it's a UK thing. Anyway, it's written by Don Miller, and he covers the whole of the experience of the 8th Air Force. But I'm right in saying that you're following the 100th Bomb Group, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. So Don's book is fantastic, and I can't recommend it enough. But it's a broader examination of the American experience on the daylight bombing of Germany from the 8th Army Air Force, which was based in England. And it's kind of overall. I mean, it even gets into the history of the Norden bomb site and where the idea for daylight bombing even came from. And it follows fighter pilots and all sorts of other people. But part of it in telling the story of what it was like to be in a bomber crew. Don focuses indeed on the 100th Bomber Group, which was this amazing group that earned, I'm not sure earned is the right word, got the nickname of the Bloody 100th, because they happened to go on a couple of missions that were the worst that anybody ever went on in terms of casualty rates. They didn't suffer the absolute worst casualty rates of a bomber group, but they almost did, and certain missions were just horrible. On one mission to Berlin, they lost 15 planes on one mission. That's 15 planes. You kind of say, oh, 15 planes, that's kind of a lot, right? And then I was talking to Tom Hanks years ago about trying to convey what that actually meant. Well, each one of these planes, 15 planes, each one has 10 guys on it. That one mission, we lost all of Easy Company. One mission, 150 guys go down. That's how many people were in Easy Company, is 150 guys. So they're losing that many people mission to mission. And they had other missions where they lost 12, they lost 14, yep. They lost 10, yep. They lost 9. You know, I will say,
well,
there
was that terrible week in October 1943, wasn't there?
That's,
which culminates in Black Thursday,
100th.
Which is, yeah.
Yeah, and yeah, that killed the 100th. So when the 100th arrives in East Anglia, in a small town called Thorpe Abbotts, south of Norfolk, when they arrived in June of 43, they arrived with 36 B-17s, 360 air crewmen. By October of 43, 12 weeks later, something like that, 34 of the 36 have been shot down.
Jesus Christ. I mean, pardon my, I mean, that
And how
is,
do you get into the plane the next day?
Well, this is the question. And John, we've been talking about actually this, around this idea, this issue, the question, how do you persuade someone to get in a plane when that's what's going on? How on earth do you do it? What do you say to people? How do you gee them along? I mean, what do you offer them?
That was a problem, right? It became a problem. Originally, there was no mission count, right? Originally, there was no assumption you would just keep on flying until you died. And then they realized that was a bad idea, so they did 25 missions, right? If you flew 25 missions, you could get home. That's in 43. The tough thing was the average mission life was 11. No planes were making it past 11, so no crews were making it past 11. So that was really, really difficult because you knew by the summer of 43, if you were an American air crewman, you were smart enough to realize not a lot of planes were coming home and coming back from missions. And it soon became apparent that 11 was the number. That if you made it over 11, you were now totally against the odds. And you had to fly 25. How they did it, I don't know. We examined that a little bit in the show. You know, everybody had their own ways. Some guys didn't. You know, some guys did break down. I don't know.
I remember reading the story of the from the 381st, which was at Ridgewell, so not a million miles away from Thorpe Abbotts, a little bit further away, because I think it was in North Essex just. But anyway, I remember the first crew to reach, I think it was 25 missions. They were on the 24th, took off for the 25th and crashed into wood.
Happened all the time.
Everyone killed.
Happened all the time. It's actually, well, I don't want to give any spoilers of the show, but these issues do come up in the show, you know.
Yeah.
The men were really, really angry in March of 44 when the American brass upped the mission count from 25 to 30.
Yeah.
And so had you been on mission 23 and you thought you only had two more missions to go, au contraire.
Yeah.
That's you tough, know, isn't it?
It's tough. And then it went up to 35. By the end of 44, you had to fly 35 missions.
It wasn't quite as dangerous by then, though, was it?
It was not as dangerous, obviously, by then. No, absolutely. The longer the war goes on.
The second half of 1943, that is the horror 6 months to beat all
horror
6 months.
It's really until right before D-Day.
Yeah.
You know, when the mission changes. So the mission in 43 and early 44 is to destroy, well, very first mission is to destroy the sub pens, right? Because it's early 43, we're trying to get stuff over to England, and the subs are just killing us, right? So the first thing they're trying to do is destroy the sub pens in Bremen and in Norway. Then it sort of turns into a larger target of just industrialization of the Ruhr Valley and factories, and really just factories, not trains quite so much in 43. And then in 44, it goes to the Luftwaffe as the target. And the idea is in early 44, the strategy changes to B-17s and B-24s as bait to get the Luftwaffe into the air to destroy the Luftwaffe so D-Day can happen. And once that works, and it does, the Luftwaffe still exists, obviously, post-D-Day, but as a much less significant fighting machine. And we, the Americans, can then have a much more significant air presence and, as a result, much less wounded and killed men.
But if you're bait and your number of missions has gone up, that must be great for morale. I mean, they know their bait, right? That really, don't they? You know, this is all quite a hard sell if you're the air crew, isn't it?
Which makes a man like Robert Rosenthal all the more amazing. And his nickname was Rosie for obvious reasons, Robert Rosenthal. And Rosie is I've written about a lot of guys. I've written about a lot of amazing men who served in the war. And he is up there with any of them, including Dick Winters. So Rosie, his story is amazing. So Pearl Harbor happens in America. Rosie had grown up in New York, Brooklyn, Jewish, Rosenthal. And he made his mom real happy, became a lawyer. He's 22 years old when Pearl Harbor happens. He joins up because to fly a B-17 or a B-24, you had to. They were usually college students who were the in the nose. The pilot, co-pilot, bombardier, navigator tended to all be college graduates. And so Rosie volunteered, became a pilot. And he spent the first year of the war flying B-17s over Texas for gunnery training for gunners. But when he did that, he put up so many hours in a B-17. He could fly a B-17 like very few human beings could fly a B-17. So he ends up in England in September of 43. And he goes on some really hairy missions that I'm not going to detail because you might want to watch a little show called Masters of the Air. But he does his 25 missions, and he finishes his 25th mission right around the time I'm talking about of March 44, right before D-Day. And what does this guy do? He re-ups. The job's not done. So he re-ups, commits to another 30 because they up the number to 30. And so he's now committed to 55 missions. He gets shot down on his 52nd mission over over Russia. And I'm not going to
But he survives,
explain.
Doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yeah, he survives. And not only does he survive, he goes home after the end of the war and goes back to being a lawyer. And then he volunteers to serve as a lawyer on the Nuremberg trials. And he's actually on the prosecution of Hermann Göring. He interviews Hermann Göring and is part of the prosecution of Hermann Göring. That's
amazing,
an American story, right?
Right there. Yeah, that is absolutely
well,
incredible.
Well, I would suggest that he's about to get a little bit better known than he was.
Yes.
But there's some other great characters from Four Babbitts and from The Hunter
well,
of
so
BG.
Yeah, Buck and Bucky are these two guys played by Austin Butler and Callum Turner. And... These are two real guys also. They have a totally different story because they're an earlier generation. They're actually before the war generation. So I don't know about the UK, but in America, you know, there was all the barnstorming and there's this romanticism about flying a plane because it's like the late 30s and planes are really new, right? And not just anybody can get in an airplane. And so these two guys, it's the Depression, and they joined the U.S. Army Air Corps in 1940, the beginning of 1940, almost 2 years before America enters the war. And they become pilots. And because they've been in the Army for so long, by the time our story starts in 1943, they're both majors and they both are squadron commanders of 6 to 8 planes each. And they're best friends, though. They met each other at cadet pilot training and they end up being best friends for the rest of their lives, very much like Dick Winters and Lewis Nixon did for their whole lives, or Babe Heffron and Garnier were best friends for their whole lives. Egan and Clevin were amazing, amazing guys. And their friendship is the core of the show. And then our fourth really main character is a guy named Harry Crosby, who is a navigator for the 100th. And he really was the worst navigator in the 100th. And by the end of the war, he is the group navigator. He is the head navigator of the group. And he's literally the only guy. Remember how I said there were 36 airplanes that arrived in 43? So he was a navigator on one of those planes. And he's the only guy from those original 36 planes that's still in the 100th by VE Day.
Yeah, amazing. And I remember from doing Big Week stuff that I seem to remember he had an autobiography, didn't he?
A memoir was
pretty good. Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. So you're not pulling your punches and you're showing it presumably kind of in graphic detail and warts and all and all the losses and the scale of it.
Yes, this show is about scale. When I first read the book and Tom first asked me to take it on, which was 10 years ago. This has been 10 years in the making.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it?
The first thing I talked about was scale. You know, we didn't just want to do Band of Brothers in the air because we'd already kind of made Band of Brothers, right? Band of Brothers is its own thing. It's its own thematic thing. It's a wonderful, wonderful, lovely, amazing thing. And we wanted to make something else. And one of the things that was the most important thing was scale. Because the air war is the tip of the spear of American industrial power. So when we start this show and we see the first mission, I think maybe we see 30 planes in the air, something like that, 40 planes in the air, maybe, if that. By the end of the show, you know, there's like thousands of airplanes in the air. You know, a mission to Moscow, I mean, I'm sorry, a mission to Berlin in early 45, you've got 1,200 bombers, 400 P-51s escorting them. It would take 3 hours for them to go over Berlin. It would take 3 hours for the first plane to the last plane bombing Berlin. That's how many airplanes there were. And that's never really been told. As wonderful as Memphis Belle is, as wonderful as 12 o'clock high is, there was not the technology or the reason to try to explain the actual scale of the air war. And Don's book is so much about that.
Yes, absolutely. And the sketch, I mean, like all aspects of America in the Second World War, the growth is so exponential. It's so rapid. Yeah. It's so hard to get your head around. I mean, you know, when the 8th Air Force first turns up in June, July 1942.
They're there in fall of 42, just but like a dozen or two dozen.
Right. Planes. And then most of them get siphoned off to the Mediterranean for Tunisia and stuff.
Right.
So they don't really get going until the kind of summer of 1943. But even then, you know, you're talking about, I mean, you know, what's the first Schweinfurt raid? 315 aircraft, 60.
And that was a big fucking deal, getting 350 airplanes in the air.
Right.
Excuse my.
No, but this is my point. To go from kind of, you know, a handful in 1942 to 315 in August.
And then 6 months later, they're up to 600, 700, 800. And then 6 months after that, it's 1,500.
When you consider the losses that are going on, you know, concurrently with the growth, it's just mind-blowing. And if you think about what has to go into sort of creating you know, these airfields, they're like a small little village, you know, before you know where you are. You know, Fort Pappas is this tiny little village in southern Norfolk with its little sort of flintstone church, and it's all very quaint and everything. Suddenly on its periphery, you've got thousands of Americans.
3,000 to 4,000.
Right. 4,000. And you've got all the infrastructure that involves, and the vehicles and the concert huts and, you know,
mail, control, barbershops. It was a little village on itself.
Right, because a village is sort of 600 people, 700 people. Mm-hmm. Then suddenly you've got 3,000 to 4,000 Americans kind of on your doorstep. The social change is absolutely huge. But this is being repeated all over this part of the world. So it's you know, right. Fort Pappas is a sort of, you know, leitmotif for the kind of the bigger experience, obviously.
And all these stories are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I remember seeing all those photos that you showed me, John, and the attention to detail was absolutely incredible. Well, the other thing I remember was this huge, I don't know whether it was a barn or a warehouse or something, just full of uniforms.
Yes. We had, you know, I neglected to mention one of the other great sort of production people, which was Colleen Atwood, our wardrobe woman, who just went into such detail. Everything was just amazing. We had a warehouse. Again, the scale, it's hard to express the scale of the show, because
we have to then express the scale of the 8th Air Force in a TV production. So how on earth do you do that?
So it's one thing to talk about it.
Yeah, so you're the tip of the spear of what an American TV industry can produce then, as in a sort of analogous with the Air Force.
Right, but so then Colleen had to make, you know, at one point I asked her, I was like, Colleen, how many wardrobe fittings did you do? She said, I stopped counting at 3,000.
God. Oh, my God.
So that, you know, there were more than 3,000 people dressed in this show. So, because, you know, when the show isn't just, I mean, again, it's hard to talk about how big the show is without you seeing it. Because we start, you know, at Thorpe Abbott's, and there's, like I said, 3,000 people working there. We go on these missions with 70 missions. By the end, you know, we see all those planes and stuff, but also some of our guys have been shot down, and they might be behind enemy lines, and they might be on a march in the middle of January, February, and that of 45. And that was a moment in history where more people were on the road in Europe than any other time. So the Russians are heading west, taking all the land, restealing in some ways all the land that the Germans had stolen in 39-40. But remember, all the Germans, the reason they stole Poland was so the Germans could live there. So now all the Germans who are living in Poland don't want to be in Poland because the Russians are taking over Poland. So they're all running back to Germany, right? Then you have there are thousands of people on the march all over Europe. Civilians, armies, POWs, and maybe we're going to see some of that, you know, but the Russian army, we it's just a lot of people in this show.
How many episodes? Is it 10 episodes?
It's nine.
It's nine. But could there have been 18? Has it been a containing the story?
Yes. There was a moment where I was just, oh my God, this should be four seasons, you know, because, you know, there's so many. Here's the thing. Also, there are so many amazing people in the 100th. And we are only really talking about a couple dozen, you know. Yeah. There are so many other amazing pilots above and beyond the guys that we're focusing on. Mm. You know, there's this guy, Cowboy Sloan, and there's Lucky Luckadoo. And
yes, well, we interviewed Lucky the other day.
Lucky is just an amazing, amazing human being. And he's actually, and actually, you know, he's one of the few, he was not one of the original 36 crews, but he was the second, I think, man from the 100th to do 25.
Yep.
I think
he's amazing.
Not Dale Dye. We have, you know, obviously Dale Dye worked on the show, but we all, there was a Captain Dye.
Yeah.
I'm blanking on his name right now. He was the first guy to make 25 on the 100th. And I think Lucky was the second.
Lucky had an interesting time because he had this awful crew that he hated.
Yeah.
Horrible to him. And
yeah.
You know, just extraordinary.
We'll take a short break and we'll be back to talk more Masters of the Air. We'll see you in a tick.
eBay Motors is here for the ride. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly. Brake kits, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only, exclusions apply.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. James and I, it's just an exclusive, isn't it, Jim?
It really is, yeah. How lucky are we? It really is. And we're getting this kind of sort of glimpse of behind the scenes. And I mean, John, it just sounds absolutely amazing. What a thing to be a part of. Goodness me.
John, I seem to remember when we spoke to you about Band of Brothers, I mean, and it would have been 4 years ago, or 3.5 years ago, at the start of the pandemic. You were saying enough Second World War is how you felt at the end of Band of Brothers. I don't want to go near it ever again. Heavens, you know, any more olive drab and I'll go crazy. Godfather style, once you thought you were out, they dragged you back in.
Yeah, and when I originally committed to it, I only committed to an episode. Like, seriously, what happened was, all of these shows, you know, the past two shows had roughly five writers in each show, and it kind of roughly panned out to about two episodes a writer. On both Band in the Pacific, and that was kind of what we were going to do on this show when they first gave me a ring. The challenge was, this was a little different than Band. I can't speak for the Pacific exactly because I didn't work on it. Band of Brothers, the book, was obviously about the 101st, and you know, Dick Winters, and it was very clear what the show Band of Brothers would be based on that book. Masters of the Air was a little bit trickier, and it necessitated a lot more research than we needed to do originally with Band of Brothers, because not only do we have that excellent book, we also had the guys. I wrote episode 2 of Band of Brothers, Day of Days, and I could call Dick any time of the day and say, okay, well, what did you think when this happened? What did you want to do when that happened? What did you, and he would tell me, you know, and so would Compton, so would Lipton, so would Malarkey. I had conversations with everybody who was still alive, who was at Braycore Manor in 1998 through 2001. And equally, they could inform me about episode 9, which was the other episode I wrote. It was not the same when we got to Masters, because the book is different and the guys are no longer with us. So my first job was to really figure out, well, what did our main four characters do for the whole war? Because in the book Masters of the Air, we see a couple incidents that they took part in. Their first mission is talked about in the book, and Regensburg is talked a little bit about in the book. But what did they do between August of 43 in Regensburg and June of 43. I still need more material, you know. So I ended up taking a 1-year research trip into the 100th Bomber Group. And that created this, which is a 250-page book about the 100th Bomber Group and 30 sources, 25 sources, 500 or 600 footnotes. And when I gave that to Tom and Stephen to read, and they did, and they loved it, Tom sort of said, I think you got to do this. I think you got to write the whole thing. You got to, you know, just write the first three. Let's see where it goes. And so I wrote the first three and he loved it. And he said, all right, keep on going. Keep writing. So I just sort of kept on writing. And so that was very different than Band. And again, I dipped back into World War II because I thought I was just be dipping in for 6 months or a year. Not quite 10 years. That was not the expectation.
John, are you done with it now? Are you? Is that it? Or you know,
I am. Right, I am okay. Done with it. I am actually done. I think I did like my last bit of business on it like 2 days ago.
But I mean, the Second World War. You're done with the Second World War. Are you finished?
Oh, the Second World War. No. No, I've never. I've come to understand. I've come to understand that that's just part of why I am writing. I didn't know that when I started working on Band of Brothers. I mean, I knew I loved World War II. I'd been obsessed with it my whole life. I'd seen every World War II movie. You know, studied it. But I was pretty tired of it after Band. But I keep on coming back to it. And I think you come back to things for different reasons, I guess. But it is the great human story. I mean, I don't want to say of our time anymore because it's not. But yeah, it's so relevant right now in particular as we see a world where authoritarianism seems to be on the uptick, whether I wanted to or not. It just has sort of informed my existence. So even making a movie, an animated 3D movie for Zack Snyder, with talking owls that are flying with swords and fighting each other. It's a really fun movie. The bad guys are fascists. It's all about fascism. And the parallels are direct and intentional. So even when I'm not writing about World War II, Al, I'm writing about World War II.
Well, Al once tried to get away from it.
I did. And, I tried to have some time off.
And it didn't work, did it?
I couldn't do it. It's like magnetic. Empty. It's magnetic north. You know, it's what I point at. As it were. So John, I mean, there were various sort of photos of B-17 was within, you know, mocked up B-17s with engines running and all sorts of stuff. I mean, surely there's a tremendous thrill in saying as a writer, because William Goldman famously says, you know, when you write a movie scene, you say, you know, 1,000 horsemen gather on the horizon at dawn, and he's like, well, you better not put that in your screenplay because that'll never happen. So maybe make it 12 and it doesn't have to be dawn, no horses, and just, you know, like paring it back. But evidently, you, to make this, you couldn't do that. So is it something else to say, you know, five B-17s form up on the runway, on the stand, and then off they go? I mean, how's that?
Dude, four?
All right, okay.
Oh, no, we have shots of 18 okay, or 20 fine. Or 25 there you go, see?
Okay,
or 30.
Sorry, I'm just trying to help William Goldman out here. I mean,
Well, it's an interesting, well, that is, there is a story, of course. You've hit on something. So certainly while I was writing, I was told, don't think about budget. What? Don't ever think about budget. And that, of course, changed, you know, when we went into real production, right? And there were things that we had to cut or pull back. But that it was Gary Getzman who was really just write it how it's supposed to be and we'll figure it out.
Wow.
And most of the time they could, you know? I mean, obviously there are times, you know, where some things aren't possible. But again, the commitment to get it right from everybody, you know, was just staggering. To see the detail. You know, again, we were talking earlier about that shot of the planes headed towards the IP that you can see in the trailer. Well, that's not just the ground below them. That's Trondheim, Norway. I mean, that's the map of Trondheim. I mean, like, if you look at the bay and you look at Google Earth, it's the same.
Yeah.
You know, like, the targets aren't just, like, maps. They're the targets for that mission.
That's amazing.
You know? And so, yeah, we all just wanted to get it right. And so many people would come up to me and say, you know, they saw a band, you know, the people on the show that worked on it had seen Band of Brothers and knew like that was what we were doing. And it moved people to give their best.
Amazing. I mean, John, I mean, when I saw you in Windsor that time, it was, you were getting very close to the end of the filming. And I detected a sense that you just weren't sure how you thought it was going to be good, but it's scales of good. And would it be better than Band of Brothers?
You never know.
And you had that kind of, you know, post-match nerves, I would say, about the whole thing.
I still have them. I mean, not a lot of people have seen it.
You know? You've seen it.
Many
very
times.
Tantalizingly, we were sent a link to see it all.
But then didn't work.
And they said, you know, from the PR people. And then it didn't work.
No.
Yeah, yeah.
This is awful.
No.
Yeah. So what can you do?
Oh, that's
cruel. But are you pleased with it? It sounds like you are.
Yes. It's like nothing that's ever been made. I mean, I don't know how to sound humble when I say that, but I am. You know, it's not Band of Brothers and it's not the Pacific. It's its own thing. And everybody has to understand that. You know, and yeah, I'm really proud and really excited, and I can't wait for people to see it. It was really hard to make. You know, we were also making it in the middle of COVID. So imagine all the things I was just talking about, and it's the middle of real COVID. Like, when I arrived in England, the stores were not open, the restaurant, nothing was open. It was still that time of COVID. If you wanted to buy a pair of shoes, you called up the store and they left them outside at the door, you know, of their shoe store. You weren't allowed to go in. And we had to make a movie like that, right? So there were 300 people just on our COVID team. Wow. That's all they did was COVID.
Yeah, that's just amazing.
Because every single day I had to get COVID tested.
Yeah, you were testing every day.
Because I couldn't go onto the set. Yeah, if I wasn't healthy, I couldn't go on the set and possibly get other people sick.
Yeah, so what a palaver.
We had roughly 1,000 to 1,500 people work on the show every day. So 1,000 to 1,500 people had to be tested for COVID every day. So when I talked to you, you know, it was a very intense shoot with a lot of difficulties, just logistically because of the scale and making it during those times, you know, and it was hard. It was a hard shoot. I won't lie.
Yeah.
But it's something special. Like, again, it's, I keep on, nobody has seen anything like this since 1945.
God, honestly, I'm so excited about it.
You will see imagery and events that no human eyes have seen since 1945, you know, when it was really happening. And that's really exciting for me. And the scale, you know, again, Band of Brothers is a fantastic piece of filmmaking. And it's not about scale. It's about almost the opposite. It's about the intimacy of friendship, which is in our show, is in Masters too. Trust me, at its core, it's about friendship, but a different kind of friendship than in Band of Brothers. And Band of Brothers was this internal thing about the small group of guys. And this is not. This is about scale. And that's the point of this show. So I'm super excited about it, as long as you don't think it's Band of Brothers in the Sky.
Well, John, I've got to say, I mean, if people's appetites aren't whetted by this conversation, there's simply never going to be. I mean, congratulations. And we are super keen to talk to you again.
Yeah.
Once Al and I have watched it and we've once got a billion up. Questions to ask you.
Yeah. I look forward to it because I know they will be, I guarantee you they will be some of the most interesting questions I will get.
Thank you so much for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to John Orloff. We'll see everyone very soon. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Bye-bye.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, US Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics US, brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.